Deutsche Welle. Inside Europe.
Hello and welcome to Inside Europe. I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. On today's programme, has the Donald trumped Putin with sanctions? Is diesel running on empty in Germany? He said he was standing down because he could barely stand up, but there's life beyond retirement for Britain's Prince Philip.
For a man of 96, he's extraordinarily energetic, intelligent, challenging, always asking questions, and quite contrary. If ever you say anything to him, he doesn't agree with you. He always says, yes, but. Very intriguing and so unlike the curmudgeonly figure that he's sometimes portrayed as.
And is Hungary's healthcare system a health hazard? Those stories and more coming up. Relations between the US and Russia have rarely been easy, but they now appear to have hit a new low. Moscow recently announced the seizure of two American diplomatic properties and ordered a reduction of the US diplomatic presence in Russia by the end of the month. The Kremlin moves come in retaliation to a US sanctions bill, overwhelmingly approved by Congress and signed into law by President Donald Trump. From Moscow, Charles Maines reports.
Donald Trump arrived to the White House promising a new era in relations with Moscow, and Moscow responded in kind.
President США, теперь Donald Trump.
There was fawning media coverage of the new American president, high hopes and champagne toasts in the Duma, where lawmakers called Trump our man in the White House. Anticipation for the Trump era ran so high, even Russian President Vladimir Putin caught some of the fever. When the outgoing U.S. President Barack Obama deported 35 Russian diplomats and seized two Russian embassy compounds in December 2016 for alleged Russian interference in the U.S. elections, Putin famously turned the other cheek. Putin's lack of response at the time was seen as a gesture to the incoming Trump White House, which was openly toying with the idea of sanctions relief for Moscow. But fast forward 6 months, and those dreams of U.S.-Russian cooperation have quickly come crashing down. In an interview on state television, Putin said Russian patience for improved relations had run out amid multiple investigations and a new sanctions bill spurred on by election hacking allegations Moscow rejects as a witch hunt. We have waited long enough, said Putin, hoping the situation would change for the better. But, he added, it appears it will not change soon. And indeed, it will not.
This legislation, we believe, will not only codify current Russian sanctions that our administration has upheld, but will also strengthen those sanctions.
On a tour through Eastern Europe, U.S. Vice President Mike Pence warned sanctions would remain in place until Russian behavior changed. Among other measures, the new law imposes economic restrictions on Russia's gas and energy sectors, measures that have raised concern among America's European allies. But perhaps more critically, the law stipulates President Trump seek congressional approval before providing any future sanctions relief to Moscow. It's a condition that President Trump complains is unconstitutional and has the Kremlin acknowledging the problem is not going away. State media carried quotes from a Facebook post by Russian Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev. In it, Medvedev warns the sanctions will remain in effect for decades, in a move that amounts to what he says is a full-scale trade war between the U.S. and Russia. Medvedev went on to say the law proved the, quote, total weakness of the Trump presidency and ends hopes for improving our relations with the new U.S. administration. Where things go from here is anyone's guess. The U.S. Embassy is preparing to downsize its presence in Russia by some 755 positions by the end of the month. President Putin has warned that further retaliatory measures are under consideration, though he voiced hope they would prove unnecessary. If the past 6 months provide any sort of roadmap, they signal that hope may be sorely misplaced. Charles Maines, DW, Moscow.
The German elections take place in just 7 weeks, and diesel has become a central campaign topic. The German car industry has been buffeted by more scandal, with reports last month that major car makers like Volkswagen, Porsche, Daimler and BMW have been colluding for decades on emissions controls and standards. On Wednesday, a diesel summit was held in Berlin, attended by car bosses and government officials. Neil King has more.
It's been dubbed Dieselgate and has its roots in the Volkswagen scandal that erupted in 2015. That's when researchers in the US discovered that software on different VW models had been tampered with so that cars would pass emissions tests. Since then, VW has shelled out billions in recall efforts and lawsuits in at least 20 countries. But the diesel drama here in Germany has escalated on other fronts. A number of courts are considering whether or not to ban diesel fuel to reduce air pollution, which would lead to car bans in major cities. And this push comes amid ongoing findings that a slew of German automakers have been manipulating vehicle design and emissions tests in order to make diesel cars seem less polluting than they are. Once hailed as a green fuel, diesel is now a dirty word. France and Britain have announced they'll be banning diesel cars by 2040, decisions which have been fueled by pollution limits set by the European Commission. But all these developments have threatened Germany's automobile industry. The sector employs around 800,000 people and is vital for Germany's economy. Cars account for one-fifth of the country's exports. Chancellor Angela Merkel's government has come under mounting pressure for not doing enough to crack down on car pollution and for being close to the powerful automobile industry. So Wednesday's Berlin summit cast a spotlight on the links between car makers and politicians. And it came just weeks ahead of elections. The result was a settlement that placated both sides. An agreement has been reached to overhaul engine software on over 5 million diesel cars to reduce emissions. That will cost about 500 million euros. Both sides were unanimous in opposing plans to ban diesel by some cities. And car makers agreed to other measures, such as self-financed incentives to encourage drivers to get older vehicles off the road. But politicians stopped short of demanding costly mechanical modifications to engine and exhaust systems. An outright diesel ban is, for now, off the table. And the country's diesel industry is breathing a sigh of relief. Wednesday's meeting may also help restore confidence in Germany's most important industry. But environmental groups say they'll press ahead with legal action aimed at banning polluting vehicles. And at some stage, the German car industry and the government will have to face up to the fact that the internal combustion engine is running on empty. Neil King, DW.
In Britain, Prince Philip, the husband of Queen Elizabeth II, has retired. After 70 years of official public engagements, the prince made his final solo appearance on royal duty. He attended a parade of the Royal Marines, of which he's the Captain General. Now 96, he's the longest-serving consort in British history, and possibly the least diplomatic too. From London, Stephen Beard reports.
Standing straight as a ramrod in the pouring rain, Prince Philip took his last salute from the Royal Marines in the forecourt of Buckingham Palace. Since his marriage to the then Princess Elizabeth in 1947, he's racked up more than 22,000 public engagements. He's made more than 5,000 speeches. He's fond of describing himself as the world's most experienced plaque unveiler.
Pay attention, because I'm now going to see the world's most experienced plaque unveiler.
It's a quip he's unveiled hundreds of times, which might suggest he's a man who's been trapped in a tedious round of official duties, who's now bowing out through physical and mental exhaustion. Not a bit of it, claims his friend, the broadcaster Giles Brandreth.
For a man of 96, he's extraordinarily energetic, intelligent, challenging, questing all the time, always asking questions, and quite contrary. If ever you say anything to him, he doesn't agree with you. He always says, yes, but. Very intriguing, and so unlike the curmudgeonly figure that he's sometimes portrayed as.
The prince is largely to blame for that portrayal. In a world where bowing and scraping is the norm and graciousness is expected of a royal consort, Philip has often been cavalier, to say the least.
It gives me great pleasure to declare this, whatever it is, open.
Press the button.
The prince is notorious for his blunt, off-colour remarks. To an Aboriginal leader in Australia, he said, "Do you still throw spears at each other?" Of a Scottish driving instructor, he inquired, "How do you keep the natives off the booze long enough to pass the test?" And he asked a female Navy cadet, "Did you work in a strip club?" But those that know him best describe a loyal, likeable character. Lady Myra Butter first met the prince when she was 8 and he was 13.
He was a very spirited, very normal boy, full of fun, very kind to me, and always a lot of fun, and we loved it when he came to stay.
Born into the Greek and Danish royal families, Philip had a privileged but somewhat rocky start in life, says Giles Brandreth.
He had quite a challenging childhood. I mean, his parents split up before he was 10. His grandfather was assassinated. His father was arrested in the year of his birth. The family went into exile. He had a peripatetic childhood. He never talks about these things.
He acquired his British stiff upper lip and brusque no-nonsense manner during World War II. He served in Britain's Royal Navy with distinction. It's said he would have made it to Admiral under his own steam had he not met the Princess Elizabeth. His biographer, Anthony Lee, says the loss of his naval career has clearly rankled.
Once the Queen became Queen, he was, in his view, as he said, I'm an amoeba. I have no role. What am I supposed to do?
But he did carve out a role, setting up an award system to encourage endeavour among the young and championing conservation causes. He's closely associated with more than 750 public bodies, and as consort, says Lady Butter, he's been an unmistakable presence in Britain's national life.
He's been such a stable character in all our lives. He's always there, and he's always been there for the Queen. And I think, you know, we're very, very lucky to have had him.
He hasn't totally left the scene. Prince Philip will still put in occasional appearances alongside the monarch. But his solo engagements are at an end. After the last one, the Royal Marines said to their Captain General, goodbye and thank you in the traditional military manner. Stephen Beard, DW, London.
And I'm Helen Senian-Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Hungary's right-wing government has come under pressure over allegations that tens of thousands of Hungarians have died over the past year due to a lack of adequate health care. A new international study shows the country's healthcare system is now one of the worst performing in Central and Eastern Europe. The revelations are an embarrassment for the country's powerful populist Prime Minister, Viktor Orbán, who seeks re-election next year. Stefan Bors reports from Hungary.
Patients are searching for medical stuff at this rundown hospital in the southeastern town of Szentes. On this hot summer day, it isn't easy to find them. They're overwhelmed by work or simply not interested in helping patients. Others have left for more lucrative jobs in Western European countries. Officially, medical services are generally free and available to millions of Hungarians, contributing to the national healthcare system. But many patients are suffering, especially those unable or unwilling to pay so-called gratitude payments to doctors. Meet 59-year-old Maria Kandesne, an experienced nurse who now works as a poorly paid caretaker in a home for the elderly. She lives in a grey apartment block, not far from the hospital. Her grandchildren open the door. Maria Kandesne is recovering from an urgent knee operation that she says went horribly wrong. She claims that the doctor in charge refused to use an MRI scanner before he operated to see what was wrong with her knee.
What happened was that the first operation was done without an MRI scan, and my knee became inflamed and I couldn't walk. But I couldn't find the doctor who treated me, and nobody else would help me. Thanks to a friend, I went to a hospital in another city where they did an MRI, and I got a partial knee replacement.
Doctors say privately they have limited opportunities to provide free MRI scans for people like Maria Kandesne. the authorities only allow a few dozen scans per hospital. In Hungary's neo-Gothic parliament building in Budapest, the government defends the healthcare system, but the opposition notes a shortage of doctors in the country, partly because many younger ones have left for better-paying jobs in other EU nations. Leftist politicians claim that 30,000 Hungarians have died over the past year due to substandard healthcare, and they say nearly 500,000 Hungarians are left without permanent care by a general practitioner due to unfilled positions. Dr. Ákos Hatasi is co-president and legislator of the Politics Can Be Different party. He says the situation has been worsening in hospitals since the current right-wing nationalist government came to power.
2.5-szer többen halnak meg, gyógyítható.
2.5 times more people died because of diseases that could have been cured. The government should have taken care of the healthcare system when it came to power in 2010, but it hasn't done so.
In a stormy session of parliament, Hungary's State Secretary of Human Resources, Bence Redvári, strongly disagrees.
75 kórházat sikerült felújítani, tisztelt képviselő.
We've renovated 75 hospitals over the last year. We've built 30 new emergency centers and upgraded another 97. And we've also built and renovated dozens of small clinics.
International studies paint a more gloomy picture. The Hungarian healthcare system recently slipped 3 places on the Eurohealth Consumer Index, a comparative list that claims to measure the consumer friendliness of health systems in 35 countries. That makes it one of the worst performing in Central and Eastern Europe. Hungary is number 30 on the list, just above the healthcare systems of Poland, Albania, Bulgaria, Montenegro and Romania. Doctors and other experts have blamed the problems in part on the controversial system of paying gratitude money to receive better services. Petra Bai is an associate professor at the Department of Health Economics at Corvinus University in Budapest. Professor Bai notes that doctors sometimes double or triple their salaries with these payments, and that's led to tensions in hospitals.
These payments are really unequally distributed among the physicians. So as you see that, let's say, according to the estimations, only 5% of the physicians get the 60% of the payments. So you can say that this creates some adverse incentives in the system. So those who are beneficiaries are certainly against any reforms in the healthcare system. The legal status in Hungary is also kind of controversial because the labor code in Hungary prohibits receiving informal payments, but the employer has the right to dispose the employees from this decree.
She also notes that other members of the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, or OECD, spent on average more than twice as much money per person on healthcare than Hungary. The right-wing government of Prime Minister Viktor Orbán has pledged to improve the situation ahead of elections next April. But it remains unclear when and if those changes will reach the town of Szentes. Maria Kandesné is now using a machine to help move her knee. She is painfully aware it will take a major effort to walk normally again after the initial medical mistakes. And she hopes that one day every Hungarian will have access to adequate healthcare.
Attitudes need to completely change. I'm not even talking about the lack of medication or other stuff. Many doctors have left the country, but the nurses and doctors who remain here should change their mindset. They should stop the gratitude money payments and think about the patient.
She isn't alone. A group called 1001 Doctors Without Gratuity has been formed, and at least one hospital now carries a sign warning patients not to make informal payments. But it's a small step in a nation that has become accustomed to doing things the Hungarian way. Stefan Bos, DW, Szentes, Hungary.
To the lagoon city of Venice, where the city's 57th Art Biennale is underway. Its theme this year is Viva Arte Viva. The Biennale is one of the world's most prestigious art fairs, showcasing top and emerging artists from around the globe. And it's also a show that has a long history of exploring social issues and conflicts through art. As Megan Williams reports, this year, the issue of Europe's migrant crisis has been taking center stage.
From the Italian side, but is also from the other side. I know very well this.
Sorry, sir, I must tell you the fact that you are a little bit going off my opinion. I'm sorry, this is what I feel.
In a corner in the central space of one of the main pavilions at the Venice Art Biennale, a heated debate is underway.
You asking the back thing about Italians. That I feel.
Or Europe, if you want.
I'm in Italy. Okay. The back thing I feel here is for you not to accept me the way I am.
Not about art, but about migrants in Italy.
Like for me, if I'm here, I get the permit. After 6 months, I don't know, would I be able to earn money to live or to eat?
Taking part in the discussion are a dozen or so migrants and members of the public.
Okay, it's your fear. It's not a bad thing, but it's probably a bad perspective.
The migrants are part of an installation called the Green Light Workshop, the brainchild of Berlin-based Danish artist Oliver Eliasson. It consists of an open space in the middle of the art exhibit, filled with tables where migrants, or anybody else who wants to volunteer their labor, make green, lightweight wooden module lamps, shaped like kite frames. Frank from Nigeria arrived in Italy a year and a half ago, after enduring slave labor in Libya and the dangerous boat crossing. He says working at the Biennale breaks his isolation and frustration at being unemployed.
Is it strange to have all these people looking at you?
No, it's nice. I really enjoy it.
So what happens in this space is basically that we have a workshop set up where people, our participants who are asylum seekers, and the general public, if they have the time, sit down and produce what we call the green light lamp. It's a very simple module.
Anna Ingberg Peterson is a project manager here. She says one of the aims is to give the newcomers a space where they interact with the public, exchange ideas and stories, where they leave behind for a few hours a day the faceless, nameless category of migrants. She says troubleshooting the logistical challenges and setting up the workshop in the middle of a high-end art show was, in a way, more important than the actual lamp making.
What stresses a lot is it's not an object, it's not the green light module itself that's really important, but it's rather the system and the network that you create around it. So in order to do this workshop inside the Biennale, we worked with a lot of people.
Everyone from refugees and the Biennale curator to local authorities.
So many, many people had to think in a different way than they usually think in order to suddenly figure out a way of how to collaborate.
Even an immigration lawyer and counselor are among the 90 volunteers. Lahoon from Gambia is putting the finishing touches on one of his lamps.
Yeah, we need some kind of sticks and some kind of heads that needs to be collecting it all.
Visitors can get a lamp in exchange for a donation of 250 euros. That goes to the NGO Emergency in Milan and Ordanza House in Vienna. The modules are stackable, which manager Peterson says is a kind of metaphor for skill building and connections that are part of the project.
We want to bring the collaborative aspect into the heart of the Biennale to say doing something together is really how we start addressing the issue. Also of forced migration, for instance, it's not an answer, but it's a modest beginning and we're hoping to continue developing it.
Megan Williams, DW Radio, Venice.
If you'd like to send us your feedback on the show, our email address is europe@dw.com. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. This is Inside Europe, and I'm Helen Sini in Bonn. In the next half hour, satire provides a release from political divisions in Poland.
Every day, when I turn on the television in the morning, I see it's a disaster, and it's still morning. It's not a comedy, it's a tragedy, written in a very bad style. It has no logic. The only we can do is to laugh, to be ironic.
Also on the programme, a victory for animal rights as the Czech Republic bans fur farming. We investigate hundreds of dolphin deaths in the English Channel. And why Spanish expats are finding it tough to get jobs back home. Stay tuned for those stories and more. At the end of last month, the European Commission launched legal action against Poland's right-wing government over a new law that it fears will erode judicial independence. Warsaw now has a month to respond to the Commission's concerns. The issue has led to mounting protests and criticism in Poland that the ruling Law and Justice Party is chipping away at democracy and the rule of law. As the government tightens its grip on the media, one journalist has decided that satirical news is a way of covering developments. Rafał Mardajczak is one half of a tiny two-man operation producing what is perhaps Poland's most popular online satire portal. It's called Aż Janek. Julian Berner has more from Warsaw.
Political journalist turned satirist Rafał Mardajczak uses multimedia as a weapon in his fight against what he believes is the growing madness of Polish politics. This is a send-up of state-run TV news, which is accused by the democratic opposition of bias and distortion of facts. Mardajczak uses original video footage and sound, but adds canned laughter to make it look like a sitcom. The result is hilarious, complete with headlines like TV station nabbed for envisioned sex with ruling party. They do it at 7:30 each evening. Or Prime Minister Beata Szydło's breakthrough decision on migration. Poland will take on any number of EU sanctions. This in reference to the nationalists' persistent refusal to accept any migrants. 37-year-old deadpan Mardajczak also appears as a spoof TV reporter for the state-run channel. In this report, he interviews a fur coat. That's because nationalist leader Jarosław Kaczyński has accused opposition members of turning up at anti-government rallies in posh fur coats. But most of Aż Dziennik consists of agency-style, brief written spoof reports with headlines that keep much of Poland in stitches. So, what does Rafał reckon is his best headline ever? It's about former Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk and now EU Council President, who Kaczyński regards as his arch-rival.
Polish government tried to stop the re-election of Donald Tusk for the EU president. It ended with our country opposing 27 countries. There were tons of saber rattling in the statements of Polish officials. So we came up with a headline that Jarosław Kaczyński announced that Poland won't back Pope Francis' second term. I guess that was quite nice.
Café Kwadrat in central Warsaw is popular with the city's actors and writers, including 40-year-old writer and theatre director Remigiusz Grzela, a fervent critic of the present Polish government. According to Grzela, satirists like Rafał Mardajczak keep up Poland's tradition of the theatre of the absurd that stems from the 1960s and 70s. It's a cruel irony, Grzela says, that while artists once used satire to fight against the then communist rulers, Poles still need satire to cope with what the world of politics throws at them. The Orwellian newspeak used by politicians and the country's slow descent into a 1984-like nightmare.
Every day, when I turn on the television in the morning, I see it's a disaster and it's still morning. And what will go on till the end of the day? It's not a comedy, it's a tragedy, written in a very bad style. It has no logic. The only we can do is to laugh, to be ironic.
Rysiek może zrobić mi tak samo dobrze jak pan, a może nawet jeszcze lepiej.
The most popular online satirical show watched by millions is called The Chairman's Ear. It's based in the offices of Jarosław Kaczyński, Poland's behind-the-scenes ruler. It portrays him as an autocrat who is seriously behind the times and is surrounded by a bunch of spineless sycophants. State-run television has tried to hit back with satirical shows of its own to poke fun at the opposition.
Witamy wszystkich!
Zapraszamy!
Co się stało z naszą klasą wypasioną, tak i liczną?
But one of the shows has gone belly up because its satire was so crude and unfunny that viewing figures took a nosedive.
Ale odszedł dość daleko.
Chytrze się w pałacu schował i otoczył się bezpieką.
Another show which attempts to rival Britain's satirical puppet show Spitting Image of the 1980s and 90s is also described as a disaster. But its maker, pro-government satirist Marcin Wolski, is Channel 2's boss, so the show is still on air.
Ja chętnie przyjmę każde razy, kiedy mi ktoś powie, że...
Wolski has made an interesting transition from once being a Communist Party functionary to becoming a writer of veiled anti-communist radio satire in the 1970s. But since Poland became democratic in 1989, he has fallen in with the nationalists, and his current targets are the European Union and those who ruled the country for 25 years. He also unashamedly glorifies Poland's present rulers. But according to Rafał Madajczak, people like Wolski do nothing to improve the nationalist's image of being pompous, aloof and self-important drones who completely lack a sense of self-irony and perspective.
If there's a mirror in their office, it's a magic mirror. The mirror that says that they are most beautiful and clever people on the planet. And we hope that with our actions we can somehow break this mirror. Guys, lighten up. Don't make fool of yourselves. We are just trying to help.
Kuba, an up-and-coming cinematographer in his late 20s, is an Auszdziennik fan, to the point that he starts each day with a look at Rafał Madajczak's latest posts on social media.
Things like Auszdziennik are necessary in this world full of hypocrisy and populism. If the national media is spreading untrue information that is full of hate, we also have access to Auszdziennik, which is full of funny commentaries on politics, because we need to put ourselves in some distance to things we are unable to have such a big influence on. It can be, in a way, a more friendly form of invitation to enter political life, just to make people more interested in the important stuff. For example, who governs them.
No dobrze, to pomyślaj. Dam znać.
And with opposition parties steadily picking up in the polls, ruling law and justice politicians certainly seem to have less and less to smile about. Julian Berner, DW, Warsaw.
The Czech Republic is to phase out fur farming. This week, President Miloš Zeman signed a bill into law that stipulates that the country's 9 fur farms must close down by the end of January 2019. It means the Czech Republic has become the 14th country in the world to end all fur farming. The decision has been welcomed by animal rights groups, including the Humane Society International. Its director of international media is Wendy Higgins.
It's a meaningful victory for animals because although the industry itself is arguably small, the number of animals that fall victim of that industry certainly aren't. So we're looking at a fur farming industry that kills around 20,000 animals every year. So that's 20,000 animals year on year who will be spared appalling suffering simply for fur production in the Czech Republic.
And what sort of animals are you referring to?
They're fox and mink. And typically those animals on fur farms are kept in really appalling conditions, very small, barren wire cages in which they're not able to exhibit any of their normal natural behaviours, and they live a life of boredom and suffering and then end their lives in a very violent death.
So what will happen between now and the end of January 2019 in the Czech Republic?
Well, those fur farms have got what's referred to as a phase-out period in order to close their business. And then by that deadline, all of those fur farms will either have to have transitioned over into something else or close up shop for good.
And what will happen to the animals that are still alive in these fur farms by January 2019?
I don't believe that that's stipulated in the legislation, and every country that brings in legislation deals with that differently. But I would imagine, and I can only make a guess here, that I would imagine that those animals, unfortunately, will still be killed for fur, but they will, at the very least, be the last animals in the Czech Republic that will ever have to suffer the torment of the fur industry.
Well, this legislation means that the Czech Republic becomes the 14th country in the world to ban fur farming. That doesn't seem an awful lot.
I think it's a massive step in the right direction. I mean, when you're talking about how enormous the fur industry is, and certainly once was, I think we've reached a turning point in the road where more and more countries around the world are deciding that it's a business that they don't want in their backyard, and they are bringing in either very strict regulations that make fur farming almost impossible, or indeed, like the Czech Republic, bringing in full bans. I think we'll see more of that. And I think in tandem with those country bans, we're also seeing more and more outlets and designers who are also getting rid of fur in their collection. So that kind of pincer movement on the fur industry, I think we really are seeing kind of the beginning of the end of what ultimately is an industry that is based on killing animals just for frivolous fashion items.
Well, most of the countries which have introduced bans are here in Europe. Is that because various animal rights campaigns have changed public opinion about the fur industry?
I think that's certainly partly the reason why we've seen a real growth in fur bans across European countries. I think it's also because respect for animal welfare is kind of embedded in EU legislation, and you really can't marry respect for animal welfare and the fur industry. So I think it's probably inevitable that we've seen that growth in fur bans and anti-fur regulations in Europe and in EU member states. But I do think it's something that we'll see more and more replicated around the world. And indeed, we are seeing, certainly in countries like Japan, where there is a ban. India just very recently this year introduced an import ban on fur from mink and fox and chinchilla. So I think that we'll see other countries following the lead of Europe, certainly. And then hopefully, ultimately, one day, we'll see an end to the fur industry for good.
So which countries have the highest number of fur farms?
I think probably I'd put at the top of the list as a fur farm offender, certainly China. And that's a really significant one for us, certainly here in the UK. We import a lot of fur from China, and fur farms in China are typically animals kept in really appalling conditions in massive numbers. Russia is also a big offender. But then, there are still countries in the European Union that also have a very concerning fur industry. And there I would be looking at countries like, France and Italy and the Netherlands.
Are there any signs that those countries here in Europe are changing their minds about this?
I think there are definitely signs that we're seeing probably more fur farming regulation or bans to come. The ones that I would be looking out for, I think Belgium is one to watch. We've already had some fur bans in certain regions. I think next on the list will be a nationwide ban. Germany very recently introduced very strict regulations that will see a phase out of fur farming there by 2022. And Luxembourg also, there was a proposal for a very strict animal rights bill that would see an end to, amongst other things, killing animals just for fur. And if that is passed and successful, we'll see an end to fur farming in Luxembourg in 2019.
And that was Wendy Higgins from the Humane Society International. Well, we stay in the animal world and head to the English Channel. British and French researchers say the number of dead dolphins washing up on their shores is at the highest level for more than 14 years. In the first 6 months of this year, close to 1,000 dolphin carcasses have been spotted on beaches in southwest England and on France's Atlantic coast. Local media have described the deaths as a mystery. But many scientists blame large-scale fishing trawlers for threatening man's closest intellectual rivals. Nick Martin travelled to England's Devon and Cornwall coasts to see what can be done.
We started seeing whales and dolphins actually floating at sea.
Beachgoers here in Brixham, a small fishing port in the county of Devon, know to call Lindy Hingley if they spot dead dolphins washed up by the tide.
We were really concerned as to what was killing them and why they were dying.
For the past 27 years, Hingley has recorded sightings of deceased dolphins, porpoises and whales, data that has been widely publicised both locally and nationally. Earlier this year, she and other researchers noticed an increase in the number of common dolphins turning up dead on the beach. The last time this happened was in the early 2000s due to an increase in so-called pair trawling, where two fishing trawlers set out to sea, pulling a gigantic net. The boats would move at such high speeds that environmentalists complained that they caught large amounts of marine mammal bycatch, that's dolphins to you and I. The practice was so harmful that British boats were banned from pair trawling off UK territorial waters, although foreign trawlers weren't impacted. Hingley said dolphins would feast on the huge shoal of sea bass, not knowing they too were being caught up in a kilometre-long net.
We are talking about healthy dolphins here. We're talking about, you know, real top-of-the-tree alpha males, alpha females, who would do everything just like you and I to survive, and they can break their own backs. The back muscle on a dolphin is incredibly strong, and they find they've ruptured their own spines. They've experienced terrible pain and suffering, with their organs literally exploding because they've been held down for so long.
And while the autopsies conducted 15 years ago at the height of the pair trawling era showed that hundreds of dolphins and porpoises had died due to the aggressive fishing techniques, this year Hingley and other researchers have noticed something different.
The dolphins all been healthy common dolphins, but they've been clean as a whistle. They look like they've just jumped out of the sea. They've actually gone into a different sort of trawl, more of a single trawl. Some of them have obviously been dead and rolled around in the trawl for quite a long time. They've had what we call cod end, which is the end of the trawl, the bit right at the back. They've actually had mesh all over them. So they're bruised. They're just bruised like a checkerboard.
135 kilometres away in Cornwall, England's most southwesterly coast, Ruth Williams is responsible for the similar monitoring of dead dolphins, whales and porpoises. She's predicting a record number of deaths, going by figures for the first half of 2017 are close to 200. Jutting out into the Atlantic, Cornwall has seen more than its fair share of dead sea mammals washing up on its shores over the past three decades. Williams, who is Marine Conservation Manager at Cornwall Wildlife Trust, says she's faced challenges in identifying what caused a resurgence in dolphin deaths.
This year, the majority of the animals, you know, well over 50%, have been too decomposed to get any information from at all. But the level of decomposition, to me, points to something happening offshore. There's been no evidence that there's any sort of massive pollution or disease incidents that's happening with the few that we have had post-mortemed. They're all relatively healthy in terms of recently feeding. There's no sort of starvation issues. And because it's widespread, and some of the injuries that we have been seeing on some of the fresh enough animals does point the finger to fisheries.
Both Hingley and Williams say some big fisheries are loath to take responsibility for their trawling methods, despite technology being available to ensure dolphins and other sea mammals don't get caught in the nets.
Locally, particularly within Cornwall, the Wildlife Trust here have trialled what's called an acoustic deterrent device. They emit a randomised acoustic noise underwater that highlights the presence of a net to any dolphins or porpoises in the area. So they'll switch on their sonar, they see the net underwater and they'll avoid it. We proved that one of these, in particular, a banana pinger, was hugely successful. It reduced the risk of accidental capture in fishing net by 86%.
But while large-scale fisheries reject further attempts at regulating their industry, Williams says this change in the law would be a minor inconvenience to fishermen, and that the pinger is desperately needed.
It's also very small, easy to fit. It didn't take any time for the fishermen. It was the cheapest on the market. It's not a throwaway device, so it can just have reusable batteries, rechargeable batteries. So it fitted all the bill. Our problem is trying to get that into the fishing industry and get them to use it.
And Sky News is projecting that the UK electorate has taken the historic decision to withdraw from the European Union after
Britain's decision to leave the EU won't help address the issue. The UK government has said it will pull out of a decades-old European fishing agreement that could lead to a fishing free-for-all in and around its territorial waters. While Britain took the lead a decade ago in restricting pear trawling, Brussels has only imposed temporary bans, and campaigners complain other fishing legislation has been watered down. Amid the drive for even larger trawlers, able to bring bigger profits back to port, can campaigners win the battle for dolphins and other sea mammals? Ruth Williams from Cornwall Wildlife Trust is confident she has the public's backing.
One, they're iconic. If anybody's seen dolphins jumping around the coast, you know, it's a memory that sticks with you. And humans seem to have this affiliation with dolphins and whales and porpoise because of that intellectual, charismatic association. But two, they're a crucial part of the marine ecosystem. They're the top predators, and without them, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with the whole ecosystem. We need to maintain that as a whole, and we can't afford to just let top predators be killed off in such vast numbers.
Europe's sea mammal deaths pale in comparison to the worldwide figure, which one estimate puts in the hundreds of thousands every year. But with low-cost technology able to reduce the incidence, campaigners here in England think in just a short time they can bring down the number of dolphins killed to reasonable levels. Nick Martin, DW, Truro, in Cornwall.
And I'm Helen Senian-Bonn. You're listening to Inside Europe. Over the past 10 years, hundreds of thousands of Spaniards have emigrated because of their country's economic crisis. Now that the Spanish economy is slowly picking up, many want to return home. However, even with years of experience working abroad, finding a stable job in Spain is still anything but easy. The unemployment rate is around 18%. Amongst under-35s, it's around 40%. Jaja Yopsa has this report on the difficulties that expats face finding a job back home and an online platform that's trying to help them. She begins her report in London.
It's 7 o'clock in the evening and Waterloo Tube Station is full of people heading in different directions. One of them is 28-year-old Iba. Originally from Spain, she's been living in the UK for the past 5 years. Iba finds London a very stressful place to live, and that's one reason why she wants to go back home. But over coffee, she explains how difficult it's been finding a job in Spain.
I have sent over 100 CVs to Spanish companies, and I have only been invited for an interview once. I initially thought that since I have international work experience and a high level of English, that finding a job in Spain would be very easy for me. But it has turned out to be the opposite, especially since I am looking for a good job with a decent salary like I have here. I am not going back to Spain if that means I have to settle for a wage of less than 1,000 euros a month.
So Eva decided to get help from an online platform called Volvemos. It's a non-profit organisation and one of its founders is entrepreneur Sebastián Sanz. He's based in the Spanish city of Córdoba.
Blanca?
Hola.
Hola, ¿qué tal? Perdona.
Sanz is at home Skyping a Spanish woman called Blanca, who's in Ecuador. She's had a good job at a university there for 3 years. But Blanca now wants to go home to Toledo. The problem is, she hasn't been able to find work there.
so Sans is advising her on how to improve her chances of getting a job.
Ha nacido con la idea de que había recuperación.
In 2016, when the Spanish economy was slowly improving, I founded Volvemos with Diego Ruiz del Arbol and Raúl Gil. At that time, they were both living in Germany. They noticed that many Spaniards living there had the desire to move back. So, since the economy was growing again, we thought it would be a good idea to reconnect migrated Spaniards with the labor market in their home country, so that at least they would not feel that Spain had forgotten about them.
A year and a half later, 6,000 Spaniards living all over the world have signed up to Volvemos. And Spanish companies looking for Spanish talent with international experience publish job vacancies on the site. Sans and his partners also offer job coaching via Skype. Alberto Matia is having a few drinks after work. He lived in France for a year and a half, but missed his homeland.
Bullicio. Alegría, no sé.
The noise and cheerfulness of Spain, that's what I missed. I think France is a very sad country with depressed people. Here in Spain, my wife and I earn 500 euro per month less than we earned in France. But it's worth it, because we have gained in quality of life and happiness.
Ouais, je t'entends pas très bien là. Non, non, ça va mieux là maintenant, vas-y. Ouais.
So Alberto contacted Volvemos for advice. It paid off, and today he works in Madrid for a Franco-Spanish company.
Bueno, normalmente lo que hago es escribir mails en francés.
I usually write mails in French. If necessary, I also make a phone call in French.
Alberto is convinced he got this job because of his work experience abroad.
Hombre, yo creo que el estar fuera, ya independientemente de que sea Francia o no.
Living abroad is a positive experience that makes you grow on both a personal and a professional level. Besides, because of my stay in France, I have learned the language. If I had not spoken French, I would never have got this job.
But Alberto says Spanish employers tend to be suspicious when someone moves back home after having lived abroad.
La empresa española en general no tiene una mentalidad.
Here in Spain, companies tend to think that when somebody returns to Spain, it must be because they have failed abroad.
But Sebastián Sanz from Volvemos says more and more Spanish companies do value international experience.
En este buscador de empleo, nosotros...
We publish job offers from Spanish companies that are especially looking for Spaniards with a certain professional experience abroad. For example, a Spanish business which might supply components to the German car industry. I'm thinking of one company in Barcelona which does that and would likely be interested in hiring a Spanish engineer who speaks German and has worked in the car industry in Germany.
However, Sanz thinks that Spain can benefit a lot more from the international experience of expat Spaniards. And so Volvemos has a wider goal. They want to raise awareness on the importance of the return of Spanish talent and advise local and regional governments on how they can increase the possibilities for this to actually happen. So far, Volvemos has started working on a return strategy with 4 different local governments and 3 city councils. Part of this strategy is creating local job platforms like the Volvemos platform, so expats can easily find the vacancies available in their region. Also, Volvemos trains Spanish recruiters on how to help Spanish expats by finding a job in their home country. They also insist city councils appoint someone who helps Spanish expats with the necessary paperwork when they return.
And that report from Jaja Yopsa in Spain wraps up this edition of the programme. It was produced with help from Emma Wallace and sound engineer Gert Georgi. I'm Helen Sini, thanks for tuning in, and we'll be back at the same time next week. Inside Europe comes to you from Deutsche Welle in Bonn.